her muted speech. From what I hear, there may be no other time, Bianca says, half goading. I know what messages come down the lines from the other cities. I know how many other cities have no messages left in them. You and I both know what we are facing. If I had wanted to think further on that just now, I would have remained in my laboratory, Portia tells her with an angry stamp. I will not give you access to the messenger's crystal. Bianca's palps quiver. I even had my own crystal, did you know? And the temple found out and took it away. I was close. Portia does not need to know what she was close to. Bianca has one obsession, and that is speaking to the messenger, sending a message back to that swift-moving star. It is a subject of debate within the temple every generation, and in every generation there is one like Bianca who will not take no for an answer. They are watched, always. Portia's position is wretched because left to herself she would probably support Bianca. She is swayed by the majority, however, in the way that most large decisions fall out when the great and the good stand on the same web and debate. The temple old guard, the priestesses of the former generation, hold the message sacrosanct and perfect. The path of Portia's people is to better appreciate it, to learn the hidden depths of the message that have yet to be unlocked. It is not for them to try and howl into the darkness to attract the messenger's attention. Passing overhead, the messenger observes all. There is an order to the universe, and the messenger is proof of that. Each generation, a few more voices are raised in dispute. But so far, that enduring meme has won out. After all, did the messenger not intervene during the Great War with the ants, with no need for anyone to ask for help? If it is within the messenger's plan to help Portia's kind, then such help will come, without being solicited. Why come to me? I will not go against Temple, Portia tells her as dismissively as she can manage. Because I remember you from when we were still truly sisters. You want the same thing as me, only not quite enough. I will not help you, Portia declares, her weariness adding a finality to the phrase. There is no speaking back to the messenger anyway. Our people need the temple as a source of reassurance. Your experiments would likely take that from them. And for what? You cannot achieve what you wish, nor is it a thing to be achieved. I have something to show you. Suddenly, Bianca is signalling, and some males are bringing in a heavy device slung between them, stepping in sideways to lower it to the taut floor, which stretches a little more to take the weight. It has long been known that certain chemicals react with metals in curious ways, Bianca noted. When combined, linked properly, there is a force that passes along the metals and through the liquids. You remember such experiments from when we were learning together. A curiosity, nothing more, Portia recalled. It is used for coating metals with other metals. I recall there was an ant colony induced to make the task work, and they produced remarkable goods. This memory from her comparatively innocent youth lends her a little strength. Many noxious fumes, though. Work fit for ants only. What of it? Bianca is attending to her device, which resembles the experiments that Portia recalls in that it has compartments of chemicals within other chemicals, linked by rods of metal. But it has other metal parts too. Metal painstakingly teased out until it is as fine as thick silk, coiled densely in a column. Something changes in the air, and Portia feels her hair prickle, as though a storm is coming. An event that always inspires a very reasonable fear because of the damage that natural fires can cause to a city. This toy of mine is at the heart of an invisible web, Bianca tells her. By careful adjustment, I can use it to pluck the strands of that web. Is that not remarkable? Portia wants to say that it is nonsensical, but she is intrigued. And the idea of some all-encompassing web is attractive, intuitive. How else could they be connected with... What you say is that this web is what the messenger speaks to us through. Bianca skitters about her novel device. Well, there must be some connection, or how could we receive the message? And yet the temple does not speculate. The message simply is. Yes, I have found the great web of the universe, the web that the messenger plucks its message upon. Yes, I can send our reply. Even for Bianca, this is a bold and fearful boast. I do not believe you, Portia decides. You would have done it already if it could be done. Bianca stamps angrily. What point in calling to the messenger if I cannot hear her words? I need access to the temple. You wish the messenger to recognize you, to speak to you. So it is Bianca's ego that really drives this experiment. She was always thus, always ready to measure legs with the whole of creation. This is not the time. Portia feels exhausted once more. Sister, we have no more time. You know that, Bianca wheedles. Let me fulfil my plan. I cannot leave this to future generations. Even if I could pass the understanding on, there will be no future generations worth speaking of. Now is the only time. There will be future generations. Portia does not step out these words, only thinks them. Fabian has seen them, living like beasts in the ruins of our cities, heads crowded with understandings that they cannot use, because all the architecture of their mother's world has gone. What use is science then? What use the temple? What use art, when there are so few left that all they can do is feed and mate? Our great understandings will die off, generation to generation, until none of those left alive will remember who we were. But the thought is incomplete. Something nagging at her. She finds herself thinking of the selection of understandings. Those lost survivors will presumably have some long-ago understandings to assist them in their hunting, and those offspring that inherit such primal understandings would become the new lords of the world. But that will not be all that they inherit. Portia leaps up, electrified into wakefulness, as though she had inadvertently touched the wrong end of Bianca's machine. A mad thought has come to her. An impossible thought. A thought of science. She signals one of her attendant males and demands to know if Fabian has returned. He has, and she has him sent for. I must work in my laboratory, she tells Bianca, and then hesitates. Bianca is half mad already, a dangerous maverick, a potential revolutionary. But her brilliant intellect was never in doubt. Will you assist me? I need all the help I can get. Bianca's surprise is evident. It would be an honour to work with my sisters once more, but... She does not quite articulate the thought, but she tilts her eyes over towards her machine, now inactive, and no longer stressing the air with its invisible web. If we succeed, if we survive, I will do all I can to take your plea to temple. And a rebellious thought of Portia's own. If we survive, it will be by our own merits, not because of the messenger's aid. We are now on our own. Chapter 4.5 Dreams of the Ancients.
Mason.
Halston started, half asleep over his work, and almost fell off his chair. Guyon was standing right behind him.
Was there something?
For a moment he was racking his brains to remember whether he had already finished the translations that the commander had been asking after. But yes, he'd sent those over for Guyon's personal inspection yesterday, hadn't he? Had the man read them already? Guyon's face gave no clues.
I need you to come with me.
The tone could quite easily have accommodated the inference that Halston was about to be shot for some treason committed against Guyon's one-man regime. Only the lack of an accompanying security detail was reassuring.
Well, I...
Halston made a vague gesture towards the console before him, but, in truth, The work had lost much of its interest for him over the last few days. It was repetitive, it was gruelling, and in a curiously personal way it was depressing. The chance to get a break from it, even in Guyon's company, was inexpressibly attractive. "What do you need, Chief?" Guyon motioned for him to follow, and after a few turns along the Gilgamesh's corridors, Halston could guess that they were heading for the shuttle bays. This was not exactly a path that he remembered fondly. Here and there, he even saw the odd bullet scar that the maintenance crews had yet to get around to dealing with. He almost resurrected those long-ago, recent days then, almost made the mistake of talking about old times with Guyon. He restrained himself just in time. Odds on, Guyon would just have stared at him blankly. But there was an outside chance that he actually would want to talk about the failed mutiny, and where would that leave Halston? With that one question that had obsessed his thoughts for those long days after he and Lane were brought back to the Gill. As he sat in solitary decontamination, just like Lane and all of Cast's crew, he had turned those events over and over, trying to work out which of Guyon's words and deeds had been bluff, and what had been cold-heartedly meant. He had wanted to talk to Cast about it at the time, but had not been given the chance. How much of the way that desperate rescue mission had gone was Guyon's plan? How much was Cast's improvisation? He had always thought the security chief was a thug, and yet, in the end, the man had gone to ridiculous lengths to get the hostages back alive. "I owe you, Cast," Halston acknowledged. But he did not know whether he owed Guyon. "Are we..." he asked the commanders back. "We are going to the station," Guyon confirmed. "I need you to look at something." "Some text there, or..." He envisaged spending the day translating warning notices and labels for an increasingly opaque Guyon. "You're a classicist. You do more than translations, don't you?" Guyon rounded on him. "Artifacts, yes?" "Well, yes, but surely engineering..." Halston was aware that Guyon had wrong-footed him often enough that he hadn't really finished voicing a properly articulated thought since the man arrived. "Engineering want a second opinion. I want a second opinion." They came out into a shuttle bay to find the craft ready and waiting, with open hatch and a pilot kicking her heels beside it, reading something on a pad. Halston guessed it was one of those approved works that Guyon had released from the Gill's capacious library, although there was also a brisk trade in covert copies of unauthorised books, writing and footage supposedly locked down in the system. Guyon would get angry over it, but never seemed able to stem it, and Halston privately suspected that was because the censorship he had ordered Lane to put in place was never going to be able to keep out the chief culprit, to wit, Lane herself.
"You must be grateful for a chance to actually walk the satellite yourself," Guyon suggested, as the two of them took their seats and strapped in. "Footsteps of the ancients and all? A classicist's dream, I'd have thought."
In Halston's experience, a classicist's dream was far more about letting someone else do the dangerous work, and then sitting back to write erudite analyses of the works of the ancients, or, increasingly as his career had progressed, of other academics' writings. Beyond that, and far beyond anything he might tell Guyon, he had come to a depressing realisation. He did not like the ancients any more. The more he had learned of them, the more he saw them not as spacefaring, godlike exemplars, as his culture had originally cast them, but as monsters. Clumsy, bickering, short-sighted monsters. Yes, they had developed technology that was still beyond anything Halston's people had achieved, but it was just as he had already known. The shining example of the old empire had tricked Halston's entire civilization into the error of mimicry. In trying to be the ancients, they had sealed their own fate, neither to reach those heights nor any others, doomed instead to a history of mediocrity and envy. Their flight to the station was brief, moving from acceleration to deceleration almost immediately, the pilot jockeying with physics as she liaised with the Gill and whatever impromptu docking control had been set up on the station. The station was a series of rings about a gravity-less central cylinder that still housed the most complete old empire fusion reactor that anyone had ever seen. Lane's team had managed to restore power to the station with remarkably little difficulty,
finding the ancient machines still ready to resume functioning after their millennia-long sleep. It was this seamless and elegant technology that had, by imitation and iteration, spawned the systems of the Gilgamesh, which had got them this far into space at the cost of only a few percent of their human cargo. With some ring sections rotating again, there was something approaching normal gravity within parts of the station, for which Holston was profoundly grateful. He had not been sure what he would find on stepping out of the shuttle, but this first ring of the station had been thoroughly explored and catalogued, and subsequently colonised by Lane's greatly expanded team of engineers. He and Guyon came out into a wave of energy, bustle and noise, to see the corridors and rooms crowded with off-duty engineers. There was an impromptu canteen serving food, rec rooms where screens had been rigged up to show footage from the Guild's archives. Holston saw games being played, intimate embraces, and even what might have been some sort of dramatic rendition that was cut very short when Guyon was sighted. Under Lane's custodianship, the engineers had become a hard-working but irreverent bunch, and Holston suspected that their great leader was not universally respected. "So, where is this thing of yours?" Holston asked. He was increasingly curious about Guyon's motivations, because it seemed that there was surely nothing a classicist could advise upon that could not have been dealt with just as easily over a remote link. "So why has Guyon hauled me all the way over here?" There were some possible answers, but none he liked. Chief amongst them was the idea that no communications between the station and the Gilgamesh were particularly secure. Anyone with a little savvy could theoretically be listening in. Of course, nobody was likely to have anything to say that was of a sensitive nature, were they? Perhaps they were. A shiver ran through Holston as he dogged Guyon's heels through that first ring section, until they arrived at a hatch linking to the next. Has he found something? He imagined the commander piecing through reports with an eye for who knew what. Something had caught his eye, though, surely. Something that perhaps nobody else had perceived in quite the same way. And now it was evident that Guyon was keen on keeping it this way. Which makes me his confidant. It was not a comfortable thought. They progressed further through the station, from ring to ring, airlock to airlock, the bustle of relaxing engineers giving place to a different, more focused flurry of activity. They were now stepping carefully through those areas of the station that were still being thoroughly investigated. The first sections were reckoned safe now, therefore left to the most junior of Lane's people, often recent awakenees of limited experience, to restore a few final systems or finish the last of the cataloguing. After that, Guyon directed Holston to get himself into an environment suit and to keep his helmet on at all times. They would be entering parts of the station where air and gravity were not necessarily guaranteed commodities. From that point on, everyone they passed was similarly suited up, and Holston knew that the pace of breaking new ground was limited by the reserves of such equipment that the Gilgamesh carried or could manufacture. He and Guyon passed a dwindling number of engineers working on key systems, trying to restore the station's basic life support to the extent where they could declare this ring section safe for unprotected work. The banter and easy nature of the previous sections were gone, the work efficient and focused. The next section they reached had gravity but no air, and they walked through a nightmare of intermittent lights and flashing warnings that threatened dire consequences in Imperial Sea. Engineers, faceless in their environment suits, fought to cure the ravages of time and work out where the old systems had failed and how to work a repair around the ancient and intimidatingly advanced technology. "We're walking back in time," Holston thought. Not back to the days of the old empire, but back through the engineers' efforts to restore the station. Once, there would have been nothing here. No light, no atmosphere, no power, no gravity at all. Then came Lane, Mother Goddess in miniature, to bring definition to the void. "We're crossing to the next ring. It has some power, but they've not got the section rotating," Guyon cautioned, his voice crisp over the helmet radio. Holston fumbled for a moment before remembering how to transmit. "That's where we're going?" "Indeed." "Lane?"
Holston started, wondering which of the three suited figures now in sight was the chief engineer. When Lane's voice came over the comm, though, it seemed to sync with none of their movements, and he guessed that she was probably elsewhere on the station.
"Hola, Chief. You sure you want to do this? You've already had people go over the section for active dangers," Guyon pointed out.
That would be the first step, Holston knew, the step he himself would never witness firsthand. Before anyone could start patching up the key systems, a crew would have to go into that lightless, airless place and check to make sure that nothing the ancients had left behind was going to try and kill them. At least the station hasn't been deliberately rigged to be like that. That had been the bane of the old astronaut explorers of the past, of course. The ancients had gone down fighting each other. They had not been idle when it came to making their orbital installations difficult to get into, and often the traps were the last things still functioning on an otherwise dead hunk of spinning metal.
"Chief, you're going somewhere without basic life support. It doesn't need to be actively dangerous," Lane replied. "No end of things can go wrong. Who's that with you, anyway? He's not one of mine, is he?"
Holston wondered where she was observing him from, but then presumably the internal surveillance had proved easier to restore than breathable air.
"Mason, the classicist."
A pause, then.
"Oh. Hi, Holston."
"Hello, Issa."
"Look, Chief," Lane sounded bothered. "I said you needed someone to go with you, but I assumed you'd be taking someone who was trained for it." "I'm trained for it," Guyon pointed out.
"He's not. I've seen him in zero-G. Look, sit tight and I'll come over."
"You will not," Guyon snapped angrily. "Stick by your post. I know you've got half a dozen people in the next section. Any difficulties and we'll signal them."
He sounded a little too insistent to Holston.
"Chief, that's an order."
"Right," came Lane's voice. And then, "Fuck, I don't know what the bastard's up to, but you look after yourself." It took Holston a startled moment to work out that she must be transmitting only to him.
"Look, I'll send to the tripwire crew and tell them to keep an eye out. Call out if there's any trouble, all right?"
"Yes, the place has been gone over, and they're working to restore full power and all the rest. But just be careful. And whatever you do, don't turn anything on. We've sent in a team for the first stage survey of it, but we don't know what most of it actually does. That ring looks like it's set up for some sort of command and control. Or maybe it's just terraforming central. Either way, no pressing buttons. And you warn me if Guyon looks like he's about to. You remember how to get a dedicated channel?" To his surprise, Holston found that he did, prodding at tongue controls that worked just like those in the mask the mutineers had put on him.
"Testing?"
"Good man. Now you look after yourself, all right?"
"I'll try to."
It did not take long for the classicist's dreams of becoming a space explorer to be cruelly dashed. The environment suits had magnetic boots, which was an idea that Holston had just sort of accepted when he was a child watching films of bold space explorers, but which proved frustrating and exhausting to actually use. Simply gliding through the chambers of the station like a diver in the ocean also proved considerably more difficult than he had anticipated. In the end, Guyon, who could apparently clamber about the depthless spaces like a monkey, had to run a lanyard from belt to belt so that he could haul Holston back when the classicist drifted helplessly away. The interior of that ring, the furthest limit of their expansion through the station, was not properly lit up yet, but there were countless dormant panels and slumbering banks of readouts that glowed their dormancy softly to themselves, and the suit lights were enough to navigate by. Guyon was setting as swift a pace as he could, plainly knowing just where he was going. Holston's own ignorance in that regard was never far from his mind.
"I have hijacked your suit camera," came Lane's voice inside his helmet, "because I want to know what the old man is after."
At that point, Holston was dangling after Guyon like a balloon, and so he felt he could spare some time for conversation.
"I thought I was the old man."
"Not anymore. You've seen him. I don't know what he was doing on the way here, but it looks like he's been around for years more than us." He heard her draw breath to say more, but then Guyon was slowing down,
hauling Holston closer and then touching him down to the wall so that his boots could get purchase. Lane's voice said,
"Oh, it's that thing he likes, is it?"
There was a coffin there, like a suspension chamber with its head end built into the wall. Holston knew that the station had come with a very limited suspension facility, as far as they had explored it, so it had not been intended for anyone to spend a few lifetimes here. Besides, what would be the point of all this room, all of the complex, sleeping machinery, just to preserve a single human body for posterity? The pad on Holston's suit signalled that it had received new information, so he took it out, fumbling in his gloves, and managed to get the data up, seeing the first-pass survey of this room and its contents. The engineers had not known what it was, therefore had noted its basic features, recorded pictures, and moved on. They had also activated some of the consoles in the room, dumped some data for later analysis by someone like Holston, then thought no more about it. These had been some of the files Guyon had wanted translated. Holston called them up now, wondering how good his work on them had been. It had been complex technical stuff, even though it had been just a surface fragment of the knowledge locked in here. Now he scanned those files again, the dense originals and his own computer-assisted translations, along with everything else the original cursory survey had recorded about this room. Guyon was looking at him expectantly.
What am I supposed to be doing?
You're supposed to be telling me what this thing is.
For this you need me here?
Holston's rare temper sparked a little.
Chief, I could just...
Your translation is mostly incomprehensible, Guyon began.
Well, technical details.
No, that's all to the good. This way, it can be just between you and me. So I want you to go through this again and confirm. Tell me just what this is. And we're here specifically so the device can help you understand it.
Guyon turned back to the coffin and hunched over it, reaching into the tool belt that he had slung from his suit harness. Holston's anxiety spiked, and he very nearly broadcast his worries directly to Guyon, before remembering to switch channel over to Lane.
"He's turning something on," he got out,
and then the whole array around the coffin lit up like a festival, screens and panels flaring and stuttering into life, and the humanoid space at its heart ghosting with a pale blue glow.
"I see it."
Lane's voice blurred with static, then stabilised.
"Look, I've got my people right outside. Any trouble, they'll be all over you. But I want to see."
"So do I," Holston realised, leaning closer to the displays. "These are... error messages?"
Guyon murmured. "Missing connections. The engineers think the main computer was gutted by the virus," Holston speculated. "So all we've got are isolated systems." And that all we've got was still an overstuffed library of esoteric knowledge.
"It looks like it's trying to link up to something that's not there. It's basically listing a whole load of somethings that it can't find."
Guyon examined the control panels, his bulky, gloved hands approaching the surfaces occasionally, but not committing to a touch.
"Get it to tell me what it is," he said.
He had left the channel open, and Holston was not sure whether those words had been intended for export.
"Listen carefully," Lane said clearly in Holston's ear. "I want you to try something with the panel. It's a routine we developed when we started up here, for cutting through this sort of shit. Seems to work on most of the kit here. You'll have to blag it to Guyon that it's your idea, or that you read it somewhere on our reports or something."
"Sure."
Guyon let him take over at the panel, bathed in the pale illumination from the coffin, and he followed each of Lane's commands carefully, hesitating every time to let her correct him where necessary. The sequence was only 15 steps, touching the screen carefully to unlock new cascades of options and complaints, until he had somehow stripped away all of the device's plaintive demands for its lost links and pared it down to what was left. Which was... "Emergency upload facility," Holston translated, a little uncertainly,
He stared at that human-shaped absence at the heart of the machine.
Upload of what?
He glanced at Guyon then, and saw a swiftly hidden expression on the man's face, clear even within the gloom of his helmet. The commander's face had been all triumph and hunger. Whatever he was really looking for, he had found it here. Chapter 4.6 The Messenger Within. Plague has worked its way thoroughly into the heart of Great Nest until physical contact between peer houses has almost ceased. Only the desperate and the starving roam the streets. There have been attacks, the healthy assaulting those they believe to be sick, the hungry stealing food, the incurably deranged attacking whatever their inner demons prompt them to. And yet the straining strands of the community have not quite parted. The trickling exodus has not become a flood, due in no small part to Portia and her peers. They are working on a cure. They can save Great Nest, and by extension, civilization itself. Portia has enlisted not only Bianca, but every scientist, temple and otherwise, that she has faith in. This is no time for reserving the glory to her peer group, after all. And, in contacting them all, she has made sure that they all know who she is, and that she, as instigator, is their leader. Her dictates twang out across Great Nest on taut wires, received and relayed by diligent male attendants. Normally, cooperation between peer houses does not work smoothly at this level. Too many egos, too many females vying for dominance. The emergency has focused them wonderfully. "This is my new understanding," Portia had explained to them. "There is a quality that these immune children have that marks them out from their fallen peers. They were born into a plagued city, but they survived. It seems likely, given how long the plague had been rife in their home, that they must have been born from eggs laid by progenitors likewise resistant to the infection. In short, it is a resistance that they inherited. It is an understanding." This prompted a storm of objection. The process by which new understandings were laid down was not fully understood, but those understandings related only to knowledge, a recollection of how to do things or how things were. Where was the evidence that a reaction to a disease could also be passed on to offspring? "These spiderlings are the evidence," Portia had informed them. "If you doubt that, then I have no use for you. Reply to me only if you will help." She lost perhaps a third of her correspondents, who have since sought answers elsewhere, and with no success. Portia herself, however, whilst having made advances enough to justify her area of research, is running into the very limits of her people's technology, and also the boundaries of their comprehension. One of the other scientists who chose to support Portia, call her Viola, has studied the mechanism of understandings for years, and passed on to Portia all she knew. Great tangled nets of notes setting out her procedures and results. The spiders are very reliant on the effortless generational spread of knowledge that their understandings produce. Their written language, a system of knots and ties, is awkward, long-winded, and hard to preserve and store. And this has slowed Portia's progress greatly. She cannot wait for offspring to inherit her colleague's grasp of the subject. She needs that acumen now. Viola herself was initially unwilling to even cross the city for fear of infection. Today, confirmation arrived that Viola has entered the second stage of the plague, and knowing that is a keen incentive in Portia's mind. Her colleagues are falling one by one to the enemy they seek to defeat. It can only be a matter of time before Portia feels the stirring of it within her own joints. Bianca is already infected, she believes. In private, the maverick scientist has confessed to Portia that she is feeling those elusive first-stage symptoms. Portia has kept her close anyway, knowing that by now there may be no spider in the whole of Great Nest that is not incubating the same disease. Except for those maddeningly few who are somehow immune. Thanks to her failing colleague, however, She has a tool formerly denied her. Viola's peer group operates an ant colony that has been nurtured to the task of analysing the physiological stigmata of understandings. This is another great advance that Portia's society is built on, and yet one that has become a serious limiter of their further advancement. There are hundreds of tamed ant colonies within Great Nest, not counting those in the surrounds that undertake the day-to-day business of producing food, clearing ground, or fending off incursions of wild species. Each colony has been carefully trained, by subtle manipulation of punishment, reward, and chemical stimulus, to perform a specific service, giving the great minds of the spiders access to a curious kind of analytical engine, using the cascading decision trees of the colony's own governance as gearing. Each colony is good for a very limited set of related calculations. A vastly skilled, yet vastly specialised, idiot savant. And retraining a community of ants is a long and painstaking task. However, Viola has already put in the work, and Portia sent her samples from the three captive spiderlings for comparison to the studies Viola had already undertaken of other members of their species. The results were delivered in a veritable rolled carpet of writing, along with Viola's admission of her own infirmity. Since then, Portia and Bianca have been poring over her copious reasoning, stopping frequently to confer over what Viola may or may not have meant. Their system of writing was originally brought into being to express transient, artistic thoughts, elegant, elaborate, and pictorial. It is not ideal for setting down empirical scientific ideas. Fabian is often in evidence, bringing food and drink, and offering his own interpretations when asked. He has a keen mind for a male, and brings a different perspective. Moreover, he seems to have lost nothing of his vigour and dedication, despite showing a few first-stage symptoms himself. Usually, when any spider comes to believe that she or he is infected, the quality of their service steadily erodes. The problem is so great that even the most undesirable male can find patronage if he has the will to work. Great Nest's society is undergoing curious, painful shifts. Viola's studies are in another language still, inexpertly rendered in that not-work script. In her writings, she calls it the language of the body. She explains that every spider's body contains this writing, and that it varies from individual to individual, but not randomly. Viola has experimented on spiderlings out of eggs, isolated from clutches where the parentage is known, and has discovered that their internal language is closely related to the parents. This was to have been her grand revelation in the looked-for years to come, when the completed study would allow her to dominate Great Nest's intellectual life. Portia herself is quite aware of the humbling genius that she is looking at. Viola has uncovered the secret language of understandings, if it could only be translated. That is the sticking point. Viola knows enough to state confidently that what her ants can sequence from biopsy samples is the hidden book that resides within each and every spider, but she cannot read it. However, her ants have a final gift for Portia. There is a passage in the Book of the Spiderlings, retrieved by Fabian, which is new. Ants of another of Viola's colonies have been trained to compare these hidden books and highlight differences. The same paragraph, never before seen, turns up in each of the three immune infants. This, Viola hypothesizes, may represent their understanding of how to ward off the plague. Portia and her fellows are briefly ecstatic, finding themselves on the very brink of success, the epidemic as good as beaten. Viola has one last comment, though, and her spinning is noticeably harder to read by this point. She points out that, just as she has no way of reading the inner book, so she has no means by which to write on it. Other than allowing the spiderlings to grow and breed a new generation that will grow into a wild and barbaric immunity, this new knowledge is theoretically fascinating, yet practically useless. There follow some days while the city decays about them, each hour sending the communication strands dancing with the grim news of yet more victims, of peer houses sealed, of the esteemed names of Great Nest who have gone mad and been put down, or who have taken their own lives by poison, because to surrender that hard-earned gift of intelligence is worse still. Portia and Bianca are in shock, as if the plague has come early to cripple their minds. They were so close. It is Bianca who returns to the work first. Her steps stutter and shudder with uncontrollable utterance. She is closer to death, therefore she has less to lose. She pores over Viola's notes, while Portia regains her mental fortitude. And then one morning, Bianca is gone. She returns late that night, and has a brief, trembling standoff with the guardians of the pier house, before Portia convinces them to let her back in. How is it out there? Portia herself does not venture forth any more. Madness, is Bianca's brief reply. I saw Viola. She will not last much longer. But she was able to tell me. I must show you, while I still can. That is ease is jumping from leg to leg, sending her speech into sudden, involuntary repeats. She is never still, prowling about the pier house while she fights to form the words, as though trying to escape the thing that is killing her. She claws her way up the taut silk of the walls, and somewhere within her body lies that keening desire to climb. To climb and then to die. Tell me, Portia insists, following her meandering trail. She sees Fabian following at a respectful distance, and signals him closer, because another perspective on whatever Bianca will say can only be useful. What comes out is pared down to the minimal, the essential, and Portia thinks Bianca has been pondering it on her return journey through the city, knowing that her ability to describe is constantly being eroded by a pestilential tide. There is a deeper book, she hammers out, stamping each word onto the yielding floor in a shout of footwork. Viola identifies it. There is a second book, in a second code, short and yet full of information, and different, so different. I asked Viola what it was. She said it is the messenger within us. She says the messenger is always to be found when new understandings are laid down. She says it dwells with us in the egg, and grows with us, our invisible guardian, each one of us, she says. Bianca turns on the spot, her wide, round eyes staring at everything around her, palps trembling in a frenzy of broken ideas. Where is Viola's treatise? Portia guides her to the great unrolled skein that is Viola's life's work, and Bianca, after several false starts, finds this deeper book. It is barely an appendix, a complex tangle of material that Viola has been unable to unravel, because it is written within the body in a wholly alien manner, far more compact, efficient, and densely organized than the rest. The spiders cannot know, but there are good reasons for the contrast. This is not the product of natural evolution, or even evolution-assisted. This is that which assists. Viola and her ant farm have isolated the nanovirus. Portia spends a long time, after Bianca has staggered away, in reading and rereading and doing what her kind have always done best, making a plan. The next day she sends word to Viola's pier house. She needs the use of their specialised colonies. At the same time, she is begging and borrowing the expertise of another half-dozen scientists still willing and able to assist her. She sends Fabian with instructions to her own colonies as well, those that can perform a range of functions, including doing their level best to duplicate any chemicals that they are given a sample of. Viola's pier house, though their erudite mistress is past helping now, isolate the fragment of the body's book unique to the immune spiderlings. But they do more than this. They isolate the nanovirus as well, the messenger within. Precious days later, their males stagger across to Portia's pier house with vats of the stuff,
Or at least some do. Others are killed on the streets, or simply flee. Great Nest's survival stands on a knife edge. Portia spends her time in the temple, hearing the voice of the messenger above, and trying to listen to the messenger that is within herself. Was it just a conceit of Viola's to use that term? No, she had her reasons. She grasped that whatever that alien artificial tangle of language is doing, it has a divine function, drawing them out of the bestial and into the sublime. It is the hand that places understandings within the mind and tissue of life, so that each generation may become greater than the last. So that we may know you, Portia reflects, as she watches that faraway light arc across the sky. It seems self-evident now that Bianca has been right all this time. Of course the messenger is waiting for their reply. This was heresy, such a short time ago. But Portia has since looked within herself. Why should we be made thus, to improve and improve, unless it is to aspire? To Portia, as always with her species, her conclusions are a matter of extrapolated logic based on her best comprehension of the principles the universe has revealed to her. Days later, the ants have produced the first batch of her serum, a complex mixture of the immune spiderling's genetic fragment and the nanovirus. Messenger and message circling and circling within that solution. By this time, over half of Portia's peer house are well into the second stage. Bianca and several others have entered the third, and are confined each to a separate cell, where they will starve. What else is to be done with them? Portia knows what else. Fabian offers to go in her place, but she knows that the late-stage infected will kill a little male like him effortlessly. She rounds up a handful of desperate, determined females, and she takes up her artificial fang, with which she will inject her serum at the point where the patient's legs meet the body, close to the brain. Bianca fights against them. She bites one of Portia's orderlies and injects two full fangs of venom, paralyzing her victim instantly. She kicks and staggers and rears up, challenging them all. They rope her and bind her ungently, turning her onto her back even as her mouthparts flex furiously at them. All language is gone from her, and Portia acknowledges that she does not know if this stage of the plague can even be reversed. Still, Bianca will be the proof or disproof of that. Portia drives her syringe in. Chapter 4.7. Not Prince Hamlet. The influx of new material from the abandoned station had slowed dramatically, every database and store having been raided and transferred over to the Gilgamesh. Holston's cataloguing duties were mostly done, and now he was merely an on-call translator for when the engineers needed help in getting something working. Most of his time he spent on Vri Guyan's private project, and if he didn't, Guyan would soon be around wanting to know why. The Ark ship was crawling with unaccustomed life, given that several hundred of its cargo had found themselves prodded back into a waking state light years away from their last memories, given hasty, unsatisfactory explanations of where they were and what needed doing, and then set to work. The ship was noisy, and Holston found himself constantly baffled by the din. Not only was there the shudder and bang of the actual works, but there was the unceasing murmur of people doing things like living and talking and, not to put too fine a point on it, having a good time in a variety of ways. It seemed that everywhere Holston went, he saw impromptu couples. Could they be anything but impromptu, given their circumstances, clinched in some manner of embrace? They made him feel very old sometimes. They were also young, just like all the Gill's cargo, save for a few tired old specialists like himself. They were refitting the Ark ship. And if I feel like this, how old does the Gilgamesh feel, eh? With all manner of toys ripped out of the station. Not least was a new fusion reactor, which Vitas reckoned would prove more than twice as efficient as the far more recently built original,
and be able to sustain economic acceleration for far longer with the fuel available. Other technology was merely being extrapolated, the Gill's systems being fine-tuned after the ancient model. In Holston's mind ran that same litany. Coattails, coattails. They were still clutching at the receding train of the old empire, still twisting themselves into knots to stay securely in its shadow. Even as his compatriots celebrated their newfound bounty, all he saw was a people condemning their descendants to evermore be less than they might have been. Then the message came from Lane. She wanted him over on the satellite. Some sort of dangerous translation or something, to be precise. Between Guyon's constant pressure and the aggressively exclusive youth of the rest of the human race, Holston was feeling quite sorry for himself by that time. He was not particularly looking forward to being made fun of, which was apparently what engineering thought he was there for. He seriously considered ignoring Lane if she wasn't even prepared to ask him properly. In the end, it was Guyon that decided him, because a trip to the station would give Holston some blessed relief from the commander's vulture-like presence. He signalled to her that he was coming, and found a shuttle and pilot were ready for him in the bay. On the journey over, he turned the external cameras towards the planet and stared moodily at the fungal grey orb, imagining it reaching upwards, vast building-sized towers of fruiting bodies bloating into the upper atmosphere to seize the tiny intruders that had dared to dispute its complete mastery of the world. A pair of engineers from Lane's original key crew, he reckoned, were waiting for him at the station end, assuring him that he wouldn't need to suit up. "All the parts we're still bothered about are stable," they explained. When Holston asked them what the problem actually was, they just shrugged, blithely unconcerned. "Chief will tell you herself," was all he got from them. And finally, he was almost unceremoniously shoved into a chamber in the second rotating ring segment, where Lane was waiting. She was sitting at a table, apparently about to start on a meal, and for a moment he hovered in the hatchway, assuming that his timing was off as usual, before noticing that there were utensils for two. She raised her eyebrows challengingly. "Come on in, old man. Got some tens of thousands of years old food here. Come and do history to it." That actually got him into the room, staring at the unfamiliar food. Thick soups or sauces, and greyish chunks that looked uncomfortably as if they might have been hacked from the planet below them. "You're joking." "Nope. Food of the ancients, Holston. Food of the gods. But that's... surely it can't still be edible." He sat himself across from her, staring down in fascination. "We've been living on it for almost a month now over here," she told him. "Better than the pap the Gill churns out." A loaded pause came and went, and Holston looked up sharply as she gave a bitter little laugh. "My starter gambit worked too well. You're not supposed to actually be that interested in the food, old man." He blinked at her, studying her face, seeing in it the extra hours she had put in, both here on the station and in sporadic waking days during the journey from Kern's world, while making sure the ship didn't consume more of its precious cargo by malfunction and error. "We're a good match now," Holston realised. "Look at the two of us."
"So, this is..."
He made a gesture at the assortment of bowls on the table and ended up getting some sort of orange goo on his finger.
"What?" Lane demanded. "It's nice here, isn't it? All the conveniences, light, heat, air and rotational gravity. This is the lap of luxury, believe me. Hold on, wait a moment."
She fiddled with something at the table edge, and the wall to Holston's left began to fall away. For a heart-stopping moment, he had no idea what was happening, save that the dissolution of the entire station appeared to be imminent. But there was a somewhat clouded transparency left behind after the outer shutters groaned open, and beyond it, the vastness of the rest of creation. And one more thing. Holston was staring out at the Gilgamesh. He had not seen it from the outside before, not properly. Even when being returned to it after the mutiny, he had passed from shuttle interior to arkship interior without even thinking about the great outdoors. After all, in space, the great outdoors existed mostly to kill you.
"Look, you can see where we're putting the new stuff in.
All looks a bit tatty, doesn't it? All those micro-impacts on the way, all that vacuum erosion. The old boy's certainly not what he was, Lane remarked softly. Holston said nothing.
I thought it would be... Lane started.
She tried a smile, then began another one. He realised that she was unsure of him. Nervous, even. He navigated his way across the table to touch her hand, because frankly neither of them was good with those sort of words, nor were they young enough to have the patience to fumble through them.
I can't believe how fragile he looks.
The future, or lack of it, decided by the fate of that metal egg. Tatty, patched, and from this vantage point, how small the Gilgamesh looked. They ate thoughtfully, Lane progressing from brief moments where she talked far too fast, trying to force on a conversation for the patent reason that she felt they should be having one, then subsiding into longer stretches of companionable quiet. At last Holston grinned at her, out of one of those periodic silences, feeling the youth of the expression stretch his face.
This is good.
I hope it is. We're shipping tons of the stuff over to the Gill.
I don't mean the food. Not just that.
Thank you. After they had eaten, and with the rest of Lane's crew tactfully out of sight and out of mind, they retired to another room she had carefully prepared. It had been a long time since their previous liaison on the Gilgamesh. It had been centuries, of course. Long, cold, spacefaring centuries. But it seemed a long time also. They were part of a species that had become unmoored from time, only their personal clocks left with any meaning for them, while the rest of the universe turned to its own rhythms and cared nothing for whether they lived or died. There had been those back on Earth who claimed the universe cared, and that the survival of humanity was important, destined, meant. They had mostly stayed behind, holding to their corroding faith that some great power would weigh in on their behalf if only things became so very bad. Perhaps it had. Those on the Ark ship could never know, for sure. Holston had his own beliefs, though, and they did not encompass salvation by any means other than the hand of mankind itself.
"What's he after?"
Lane asked him later, as they lay side by side beneath a coverlet that had perhaps been some ancient terraformer's counterpane thousands of years before.
"I don't know."
"I don't know either," she frowned. "That worries me, Holston. He's even got his own engineers doing all the work, you know that. He took his pick from the cargo, woke up a bunch of second stringers and made them his own personal tech crew. Now they're installing all that stuff you're helping him with, fitting the Gill with it, and I don't know what it does. I don't like having things on my ship that do things I don't know about."
"Are you asking me to betray the Commander's trust?"
Holston was joking as he said it, but then he was suddenly stung by the thought. "Is that what this is about?" Lane stared at him.
"Do you think that?"
"I don't know what to think."
"What this is about, old man, is me wanting to scratch an itch without messing up the way my crew works. And..."
He could hear her trying to harden the edge in her voice and hear it crack a little, even as she did so.
"And you know what? I've been on my own a lot over the last... 200 fucking years, is what? I've been on my own, walking around the Gill and keeping him together. Or with some of my crew sometimes to fix stuff. Or sometimes Guyan was there. Like, that's better than being on your own. And there was all that mad stuff. The mutiny, the planet. And I feel like I forget how to talk to people sometimes when it's not the job. But you..." Holston raised an eyebrow. "You're fucking awful at talking to people too," she finished viciously. "So maybe when you're around it doesn't feel so bad. Thank you very much."
"You're welcome."
"Guyan's thing, it's for uploading people's brains into a computer."
It felt oddly good for him to no longer be the sole custodian of that information. Otherwise, only Guyan knew, as far as Holston was aware. Even his tame engineers were just working to rote, each on their own piece. Lane considered that.
"I'm not sure if that's a great thing."
"It could be very useful." Holston's tone of voice did not even convince himself. Lane merely made a sound. Not a word. Not anything, really.
just to show she'd heard him. It left Holston turning over in his mind what little he had learned about the device from the technical manuals Guyon had set him to work on. They had all been written for people who already knew what the device did, of course. There was no handy moment when the authors had stopped and gone back to explain the basics for their unthinkably distant monkey descendants. Holston was becoming sure that he now knew what the upload facility was, though. More, he thought that he might have seen the result of one, and what happened when someone was mad enough to make themselves its subject. For out there, in the distant dark around another world, in her silent metal coffin, was Dr. Avrana Kern. Chapter 4.8 Age of Progress. Ever afterwards, Bianca has suffered from momentary fits, stumblings in speech and gait, sudden epilepsies when she is cut adrift from her surroundings for varying periods of time, her legs drumming and spasming as if trying urgently to impart a message in some idiolectic code. But she has survived the plague, and when a fit is not upon her, retained her mind. For Viola, whose biochemical genius furnished the means, the cure came too late. Many others, great minds, great warriors, leading females of peer houses, starving males in the gutter, all have been struck down. Great Nest has been saved, but thousands of its inhabitants were not so lucky. Other cities were similarly affected, even with production of the cure taking over the work of every suitable ant colony, and the theoretical basis being sung down the lines that link the spider communities together. The disaster has been averted, but narrowly. It is now a new world, and Portia's people recognise the fragility of their place in it. A great many things are poised on the point of change. It is not Portia herself who first grasps the wider import of her cure. It is hard to say which scientist was first to the mark. It is one of those ideas that seems simultaneously to be everywhere, exciting every inquiring mind. Portia's treatment has allowed living adult spiders to benefit from a foreign understanding. Yes, what was transferred was an immunity, but surely the process would work with other understandings, if they can only be separated out and their page noted in Viola's great book of the body. No longer will the spread of knowledge be held down by the slow march of generations, or by laborious teaching. The need for this technology is great. The depredations of the plague have made understandings hard to find. Where once a given idea might be held within scores of minds, now there are just a handful at best. Knowledge has become more precious than ever. It is only a few years after the plague that the first idea is transferred between adults. A somewhat garbled understanding of astronomy is imparted to a male test subject, as are all such, given some failures in earlier experiments. From there on, any spider may learn anything. Every scientist of Portia's generation and beyond will stand on the shoulders of the giants that she chooses to reside within her. What one knows, any can know, for a price. An economy of modular, tradable knowledge will swiftly develop. But that is not all. After she is recovered, Portia presents Bianca to the temple. She explains about her fellow's contribution to the cure. Bianca is permitted to address the assembled priestesses. There has been a shift of orthodoxy in the wake of the plague. Everyone is having to stretch their minds to fill the gaping void left by all those who did not survive. Old ideas are being revisited, old prohibitions reconsidered. There is a great feeling of destiny, but it is a self-made destiny. They have passed the test. They are their own saviours. They wish to communicate something to that one point of intellect outside their sphere, the most basic, essential signal. They wish to tell the messenger, "We are here." Bianca's battery, in and of itself, does not make a radio transmitter. Whilst the experiments with the transmission of understandings between spiders progress, so does the investigation into the transmission of vibrations across the invisible web that is strung from their world to the distant satellite and beyond. Years later, An aging Bianca and Portia are amongst a crowd of the intimates of the temple, now ready to speak to the unknown, to cast their electromagnetic voice into the ether. The replies to the messenger's mathematical problems, that every spider knows and understands, are ready for transmission. They wait for the messenger to appear in the night sky above, and then they send that unequivocal first transmission. We are here. Within a second of the last solution being sent, the messenger ceases its own transmissions, throwing the whole of Portia's civilization into a panic that their hubris has angered the universe. Several fraught days later, the messenger speaks again. Chapter 4.9 Ex Machina. The signal from the green planet resonated through the Bryn 2's sentry pod like an earthquake. The ancient systems had been waiting for just this moment, it seemed forever. Protocols laid down in the days of the old empire had gathered dust through the ages, through the entire lifespan of the new species that was even now announcing its presence. They had grown corrupted. They had lost their relevance, been overwritten, been infiltrated by the diseased spread of the uploaded Kern persona that the sentry pod had been incubating like a culture all these years. The systems received the signal, checked over the sums, and found them within tolerance, recognized that a critical threshold had been passed with respect to the planet below. Its purpose, rusty with eons-long disuse, was abruptly relevant again. For a recursive, untimed moment, the systems of the sentry pod, the sea of calculation that boiled behind the human mask of Eliza, were unable to make a decision. Too much had been lost, misfiled, edited out of existence within its mind. It attacked the discontinuities within its own systems. Whilst it was not truly a self-aware artificial intelligence, it nevertheless knew itself. It restored itself, worked around insoluble problems, reached the right conclusion by estimate and circuitous logic. It did its best to awaken Avrana Kern. The distinction between living woman, uploaded personality construct, and pod systems was not finely drawn. They bled into one another, so that the frozen sleep of the one leaked nightmarish dreams into the cold logic of the others. A lot of time had passed. Not all of Avrana Kern remained viable. Still, the pod did its best. Dr. Kern awoke, or she dreamt of waking, and in her dream, Eliza hovered at her bedside like an angel and provided a miraculous annunciation. This day is a new star seen in the heavens. This day is born a saviour of life on Earth. Avrana fought with the trailing weeds of her horrors, struggling to resurface enough to understand what was really being told to her. She had not been truly conscious for some time. Had she ever been? She had confused recollections of some dark presence, intruders attacking her charge, the planet below that had become her purpose, the sum total of her legacy. A traveller had come to steal the secret of her project, to rob her of the immortality represented by her new life, by her progeny, by her monkey children. Had it? Or had she dreamed it? She could not separate the fact from the long, cold years of sleep. "I was supposed to be dead," she told the watchful pod. "I was supposed to be locked away, oblivious. I was never supposed to dream." "Doctor, the passage of time appears to have led to a homogenization of information systems within the sentry pod. I apologize for this, but we are operating beyond our intended parameters." The sentry pod was designed to lie dormant for centuries. Avrana remembered that much. How long would it take, the virus, to spark intellect into generations of monkeys? Did that mean that her experiment was a failure? No, they had signaled at last. They had reached out and touched the ineffable. And time was suddenly no longer the currency it once had been. She remembered now why she was in the sentry pod at all, performing this function that had been meant for someone far more disposable. Time didn't matter. Only the monkeys mattered, because the future was theirs now. Yet those troubling half-dreams recurred to her. In her dream, there had come a primitive boat of travellers claiming to be her kin, but she had looked at them and seen them for what they truly were. She had scanned through their histories and their understandings. They were the mould that had grown on the corpse of her own people. They were hopelessly corrupted with the same sickness that had killed Kern's own civilization. Better to start anew with monkeys.
"What do you want of me?"
she demanded of the entities that surrounded her. She looked into their faces and saw an infinite progression of stages between her and the cold logic of the pod systems, and nowhere could she say where she herself ended and where the machine began. "Phase two of the Uplift Project is now ready," Eliza explained. "Your authority is required to commence."
"What if I died?" Avrana choked out,